for March 19, 2007 will come to order. We have an item of committee business before we get to our agenda. Representative Butler.
Mr. Chair, I move that a draft be requested from Legislative Council to allow the Department of Revenue more options in distributing the CAFA dollars.
Thank you. Representative Butler moves that a draft be requested from Legislative Council to allow the Department of Revenue more options in the distributing of the CAFA dollars. The discussion of the motion. May I just say, as that goes, Paul has done an exhaustive search to find a bill with a relating clause that would allow us to make the change that we've been discussing for several weeks. Couldn't find one, so the Speaker has agreed to the introduction of a bill. In order to do that, we have to ask him for it. And the purpose of this motion is to ask him for it.
Okay.
Is there any further discussion? Is there any objection to the motion? Hearing none, the motion is approved. And thank you, Representative Butler, for moving that. And I'll sign the letter now. Okay. Thank you. We did get slightly out of order on that, and we may have that for introduction tomorrow or the next day. We're going to go slightly out of order and do our work sessions first. I want to make sure we have a quorum during our work sessions.
We'll be there.
You're all here. And so let's open a... Where's my agenda? Let's open a work session on House Bill 2026. We'll hear from Chris on this. While he's getting settled, I'll simply say that we have General Caldwell in the back in case we have any questions. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2026 makes an administrative correction to a bill that was passed last time. In the 2005 session, the Assembly passed House Bill 2933, which was intended to exempt all active duty military compensation earned within Oregon. The language in the bill referred to a change in the status from Title 32 to Title 10. So the effect of that was it was only effective for National Guard members. Reservists never change status from Title 32 to Title 10. They always serve under Title 10, so they were not affected by the prior legislation. This legislation, the wording has changed so that the exemption applies to active duty that is performed while members are away from home. They're required to be away from home for at least 3 weeks. So that change in the wording extends the treatment to military reservists serving in Oregon. Active duty compensation.
In Oregon?
In Oregon.
Okay. Questions for Chris?
Mr. Chair, we're in work session.
We are.
And I just wanted to comment that we do have a new fiscal impact relating to that. And I think, Mr. Chair, we contemplated in the 2005 session that this would have been something we had resolved and probably something that we heard more about in the interim than probably most any other item of things that we had done or thought we had done. So with that, Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2026 to the floor with a due pass motion.
Representative Butler moves House Bill 2026 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I can see I'm looking at the wrong bill. That doesn't help. Discussion. I'm just wanting to make certain that I have this correctly figured out, and that is that we already had an exemption for military duty compensation for members of the armed forces who are Oregon residents but who are overseas in combat or something like that, and that the law that we passed 2 years ago was intended to deal with those who were called up who were on active duty in-state, but in fact it only applied to National Guard and didn't apply to the Reserve. And this is the idea of this bill is to fix that. So the category is getting smaller and smaller that we're dealing with, hence the very small fiscal.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Anything else? Is there any objection to the bill? I don't see any. Would you call the roll, please?
Representative
Representative Berger.
Aye.
Representative Brand.
Aye.
Representative Butler.
Yes.
Representative Galpin.
Aye.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Excuse.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Aye.
Representative Pitt.
Aye.
Chair votes aye. And the measure having reached the required majority is passed. Who would like to carry this bill?
Representative Berger was the person who was
I'd be happy
the work,
to.
Work group last session, Mr. Chair.
I'd be happy to carry this bill, unless somebody else wants.
Okay, well, I got a hand from Representative Gelser.
Well, she can. I don't need to carry it. Gelser.
Okay.
She did have her hand up first.
I did a handy good vet bill today.
You did.
So
you
it's
did.
Somebody else's turn.
Somebody else's turn, Russell. Yes.
That's good.
But you see, we get to fight over the bills that we all like. very good. Representative Gelser will carry the bill, and we'll close the work session on House Bill 2026. And then we'll open a work session on House Bill 2023. And Mary, would you give us a summary of this bill and also describe the dash ones for us?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. The original bill, 2023, will modify military service requirements needed to qualify for a homestead property exemption of $60,000 to include members of the National Guard and military reservists who served 178 days or more under Title 10 for at least one of the days of service falls within the tax year in which the exemption is claimed. It permits a retroactive application for exemption that would be for all claims submitted on or after 2001. The revenue impact for that bill has been adjusted upward based on survey data that I received from the National Guard, Carl Jorgensen specifically, and the numbers have increased substantially since 2 years ago, but the basic impact, mainly from the retroactive piece, would assign almost a $6.8 million impact to 07-09, and then it gets back to the normal recurring impact of about $1.8 million in 09-11. The amendment that was drafted would do the same thing with the exception of allowing claims on or after July 1, 2005. With that particular, with the dash one amendment, the impact would roughly be $3.2 million in the biennium, because you do have a retroactive piece to 2005, but then in 2009-11, it goes back to $1.8 million.
Okay.
Question, Stan?
Yes, Representative Butler.
Mary, how is the this retroactive piece with the dash one amendment? The retroactive doesn't take it back as far as the House Veterans Committee had recommended, but it does take it back to 2005. How is that administered locally? Will that be a actual amendment locally and then a refund of taxes collected?
And if the original bill is passed to 2001?
As it is proposed to be amended for 2000 and it takes it back to 2005, not 2001.
The amendment, Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, yes. The amendment, the dash one amendment, takes it back to 2005. There would have to be some kind of refund process in place in order to do that. Although there weren't very many people that qualified for the original bill because of the language, which I've not gotten into here, but there were very few people that could qualify because in order to do so, you had to actually serve the 100 and make the switch from 32 to 10 and serve 178 days all within the same tax year. And virtually no one, some people were given notice of switching in a different tax year and then didn't serve till later. That would have disqualified them. Some people overlapped tax years. That would have disqualified them. So when it all came down to how many people qualified and from the original bill, I doubt that there's going to be very many people that it would require a huge administrative task to deal with that.
Mr. Chair, I'm looking for the administrative mechanism, how that's going to be. How do we?
Your question got me looking for it, too, Representative Butler. Where is that in here?
I don't believe that's in here. The department might be able to address that.
Do you want to talk about that, Mr. Phillips? It is an interesting question. We're going back to 2005, and yet the one part of the bill says that an application has to be made by August 1st, following the end of the tax year. Well, that date's passed for 2005. So is there a mechanism in here or in something else to allow for people to apply for 2005 who now qualify but didn't under the original law?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, John Phillips of the Department of Revenue. I don't know of a mechanism, but what I would anticipate would happen is, one, the general and his staff will provide some kind of a mailing or notice, and I don't want to commit into anything, but I'm suspecting that that's a typical modus operandi, and we would probably do a news release so that people would know in coordination and conjunction with the counties. Also, I suspicion, but I don't have confirmation, that many of the counties have applications that they've either held or they know of the people. County assessors tend to know their, some of the county members, and they've been in contact with them. They've denied them. They might have the application still there. But I suspect that's where most of them will be picked up.
Well, if I could follow up on Representative Butler's question, then even though there doesn't appear to be a mechanism in the bill for dealing with applications for old years, you think that will happen anyway? That the counties will make up a procedure for that, even though it's not specifically in the law?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think they will do their best to notify everyone. I think the one critical word that really caused us the problem was this word initially in line 38 on page 2. And I think there's a known subset of individuals who serve after that date, January 1 of 2005, but they weren't they had not initially served. They weren't initially ordered to serve on or after that date. And so there are people that were actually serving in places in Afghanistan or in Iraq that didn't qualify simply because they were ordered to serve prior to January 1, 2005. And again, I suspect, and I think Mary got some information on data of those who had been ordered to serve from specific units in Oregon prior to that date.
Right.
So it would be my suggestion that we would work closely with the general to identify those groups and maybe do some kind of a direct notice.
So it's your position then that this bill with the amendment would accomplish what the legislature intended last time?
Mr. Chair, I try never to speculate on what you.
I should ask it a different way. The idea last time was to give this kind of a break to people who served 180 days or more,
mm-hmm.
after January 1, 2005, and yes. This bill with the Dash One Amendment would improve the likelihood that they would actually get a tax break, because it would remove some of the complications that prevented people from getting it. Is that a fair statement?
It's a fair statement, and there's a number of issues that came up that I think this bill will cure.
Okay.
We've worked very hard with the general and his staff and with people who have applied and with counties to make this fix those issues.
All right. Was there something else, Representative Butler?
Yes, Mr. Chair. The concern that I had then, again, this bill comes to us after having been properly vetted having been heard in the Veterans mm-hmm. Affairs Committee, excuse me. That was really bad. They thought they were doing something retroactively to September 11, 2001. Did they have any concept that just a small change back to 2005 would cost local governments as much as $3.5 million?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and Representative Butler, I don't recall a conversation about the actual revenue impacts going back. I don't recall.
Okay. And kind of a final question, if I may, Mr. Chair. I am concerned that there is both a local cost as well as the local schools cost, but I would like to have some assurance that the $3.5 million that we're talking about currently in local governments is spread somewhat throughout all 36 counties in an equitable manner based upon the service of our men and women in the armed services. Is there any indication that one small county, that Lake County sends out more, three times per capita more people than Multnomah County?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I think we've done some analysis during the interim and on some issues that you heard about who was affected, but I don't recall what the distribution on those.
General Caldwell is advancing. Perhaps he can give us some more information.
Marching forward.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Brigadier General Mike Caldwell, Deputy Director of the Military Department. Your previous testimony is accurate with respect to this bill being this issue being a major issue with most of the guardsmen. I think to answer your question, Representative Butler, it slices pretty much evenly across the board. We have deployed roughly 7,300 out of 8,500 possible soldiers and airmen. 7,350 of them have been deployed since September 11th, 2001. The majority of those were not in combat. I would tell you that probably 4,000 to 5,000 of those were actually sent overseas, and probably about half of them were actually in combat. When you look at our roles, to answer your question, interestingly enough, the more rural counties, we typically have a higher percentage of service members out of the rural counties, but in raw numbers, they clearly don't measure up. For instance, in Eastern Oregon, in your area, there's one company in Ontario, and that company is a 120-person company. It typically manages to keep around 110, 120 folks in it, and that encompasses both Mount here in Harney County, and Harney County's got a unit as well in Burns, small unit, 60 people. So you take those 60 people, divide them against the number of people in the county, you're going to get a better percentage than you will in Marion County, for instance. But I think the other thing that we've noticed, that about 25, maybe as much as 30% of our folks are actually property owners. The remainder of them are 18, 19, 21, 22-year-old soldiers citizen soldiers who are either in our organization to get money to go to school or do something different than what they were doing on the farm or whatever case they may, whatever motivates them to join. So there isn't a large number of property owners that actually are represented in our organization as much as the organization is, as large as it is. So the impact, I think, is going to be difficult to really go down and really determine, unless we do run all 8,500 people by the eaches and say, when do you own property and what county do you live in? I could get you a county-by-county zip code breakout and would tell you exactly who's in each county. And if there is an anomaly in there that shows that Gillam County, suddenly we realize we've got 100 people in Gillam County, which I know we don't, but that would disrupt a small county like that. It would be devastating to have, and all 100 of them were senior people that owned property. I mean, it could be a real hit, but I can't imagine that being the case, knowing our organization.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. My concern is twofold. Number one, proportionately, Oregon has probably more than most other states, has more than most other states participating in the Guard and active duty overseas. Number two, I do know that Harney, Mount Hur, Baker, and Umatilla County all have very active Guard units that are fully deployed as much as possible. I mean, it's a tremendous disruption to our community, and I shouldn't say it like that because it doesn't sound, truly the way that it comes across. Those people are giving, they're putting life and limb on the line every day, and they're doing so at the director of the commander-in-chief, and we honor them for that. But I also am concerned that those counties, particularly that have those large units that have been called out for long periods of time, would not be severely and adversely affected. And I think that General Caldwell, Brigadier General Caldwell, is exactly right when he says that a large number of those folks are young men and women without homes, without a lot of real property. I'm hopeful that Mary has taken that into consideration in coming up with these account numbers that we're talking about here. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions for our two witnesses? Thank you, gentlemen, very much. We appreciate
the opportunity to get this fixed and and get it rolling.
Well, actually, you know, General, while you're here, let me ask one more question, and I'll ask Mary. I think essentially the same one. We thought we had dealt with this 2 years ago.
Yes, sir.
And at that point, as far as you know, the fiscal impact at the time that the bill passed last time was already considered in the bill.
Yes, sir.
Last time. Thank
yes,
you.
Sir.
Thank you very much,
yes, sir.
Appreciate it. And that's the question I have for you. When we adopted a similar bill 2 years ago, the fiscal impact statement at that time assumed what we're doing now, didn't it?
Yes, it does. Yes, it did. Same thing.
So the legislature thought they were spending that local money then, and in fact didn't.
However, it was a smaller revenue impact, Mr. Chair, because it had a smaller number attached to the number of people that we thought would actually be deployed. And making the switch from Title 32 to 10, it only assumed that perhaps each eligible person would get one exemption because of the timing involved. Whereas right now, I've been told
you could get up to three.
And I'm estimating based on two. That's the average.
Okay.
And then the numbers are a little bit larger too. They were right on for 05, but since 05, in 2005, they were, I think, the estimate from Mr. Jorgensen, sorry. Thank you. It was about 150, 180, and I think we estimated 150 in 2005, and I think in subsequent years, Mr. Jorgensen's estimating about 260 per year, and now, so it's changed the numbers slightly.
Mr. Chairman, I might just ask,
yes,
when we did make the changes about the Title 10 to Title 32 back, or 32-10 back to 32, it did include the reserve components other than the National Guard, which work for the President of the United States. We work for the governor until we're called by the President. So there was a difference in that, and it's a small number in Oregon. Like I said, we're 8,500 strong, and I would estimate that the total reserve population in Oregon beyond that is probably somewhere around 2,500. So you're probably looking at around 10,000-11,000 National Guard and reservists throughout the state of Oregon. So that is one factor that's added in here that wasn't in the last go around. That wasn't part of the play. So I think, and again, the other thing that has occurred is we've had another major mobilization. We got 940 some people that were mobilized and sent to Afghanistan this past year. We have another 150 or so that are going to be mobilized in June, July, August time frame and be sent out. Now, I would love to tell you that, you know, we don't see anything on the horizon, but that just simply isn't accurate. We're dealing daily with the National Guard Bureau on where we fit in the rotational cycles, and we still have other units that are really coming up again now for their second time. We've completed 100% of our units have been deployed in the Oregon Army National Guard, and now we're starting to look at the second go. And we're debating those, we're discussing those with the National Guard Bureau on where they fit in the rotational cycle right now. So this is depending on the world situation, depending on what this country does and decides to, how they decide to, this country decides to handle our current situation, will dictate how many more rotations that we have. And my crystal ball isn't any better than anybody in this room. So I really couldn't tell you. I mean, I can guess just like you can, but that's all I can do.
Thank you, General. Yes, Representative Butler.
Mr. Chair, I would like to move the Dash 1 amendments to 2023, dated 3/14/07.
I don't have them. Oh, sorry. Yes. Okay. Representative Butler moves the Dash 1 amendments. Is there a further discussion of the Dash 1s? Is there objection to the Dash 1s? Seeing none, it is so ordered, and the Dash 1s become a part of the bill. On the bill?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2023 as amended with the Dash 1 amendment to the floor of the House with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Butler moves House Bill 2023 with as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? I do note that there's one significant change, and I'd like to find out a little more about this business of applying to more than one year. The way this bill is worded, as I understand it, I can see readily how it could apply to 2 years because the 178 days overlaps two different years. How do you get it to apply to 3 years? Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, it's the 170, it's more than 178 days. From what I understand, the term of service right now is anywhere from 15 to 24 months.
Ah.
So you could have, literally.
So we're talking about people who are actually gone, serving in Iraq or Afghanistan for the bulk of 3 years, depending upon how it's pulled together. Certainly gone for one entire year, and then pieces of the ones on either side.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that makes now I'm understanding the bill a lot better than I did. Is there further discussion of the motion? If not, please call the roll.
Aye. Representative Bruin.
Aye.
Representative Butler.
Yes.
Representative Nelson.
Aye.
Representative Olson.
Yes.
Representative Green.
Excused.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Aye.
Representative Witt.
Aye.
And Chair Weinhardt.
Chair votes aye. The motion, having received the required majority, is adopted. Is there, who would like to carry this bill? Two at the end. You two want to? No, we're not going to do that.
Representative Witt.
Representative Witt, would you carry the bill?
Sure.
Thank you. Representative Witt will carry the bill, and we will close the work session on House Bill 2023. Thank you, and we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3050. And I think Paul's on that one. Thank you, General. Paul?
Mr. Chair, House Bill 3050, this is your initial hearing on this bill. It was introduced by you, the committee, several weeks ago. And the bill does a couple of things. One is it gives more definition to the close of session forecast or close of session estimate and what that refers to. It goes back to ORS 291.349, which is describes the forecast process currently, and also the kicker calculation as it's determined in statute. And what the bill does is it requires the governor is the one who has causes the forecast to be prepared. And this specifies the governor shall require the Department of Administrative Services to make an adjustment on the close of session forecast. And that adjustment is, you can see on lines 17 and 18 and 19. The adjustment is determined by adding an amount equal to the average of the differences between the estimates in prior biennia and the actual amount. In other words, the deviation between actuals and forecast amounts. And I'll show you what those have been in just a minute. It does say for prior biennia, so there would be an implementation issue of how many biennia would you go back and use for that calculation. Then the other key part of the bill is on page 3, which does one of the things that we have noticed over the years in terms of the forecast process itself. There's a lot of elements of it that are kind of practice, really, and are developed in practice over the years. The modern forecast process goes back to 1981. That's when the current forecast was set up. This first state economist was in 1980 and was given the role of designing a forecast and releasing an update every quarter. So we've had these quarterly forecasts ever since. And the statutes currently only require Department of Administrative Services release a quarterly update. It doesn't really spell out much what's to be in that forecast or when the dates are. In fact, even the dates that we've come to recognize, September 1, December 1, March 1, those are all kind of by convention. None of that is in statute. So this does go in and spell out some of that. It does say that for example, no later than the 2 months following the end of a quarter, for example, is when a forecast needs to be released. It says that directs Department of Administrative Services to forecast general fund lottery and general fund resources, how much is to be received in the current fiscal year and the current biennium and the two succeeding biennia. So, and that's more or less what is done now. Occasionally you get out an extra biennium when they just make that transition, but it's always at least two biennia out. The language that we have in there now about who to report to is similar to what's done in practice. So the revenue officer, the fiscal officer, the emergency board, and to the legislative assembly in session. It does require that the department issue a quarterly statement setting forth methodology and assumptions. That is currently done, and that basically is your forecast, the economic forecast that underlies the revenue numbers. Obviously, you have to have some assumptions about how much the economy will grow in order to make that forecast. So all of that is done in practice, but this spells it out a little bit more clearly. And then the key element to the bill is in Section 3, where it says that the difference between the actual amount of revenue and the adjusted forecast shall be put into an emergency reserve fund. And, of course, when this bill was drafted, you had not approved House Bill 2707. So I would assume that the Oregon Rainy Day Fund that you approved in 2707 would become the target of that transfer. The bill also says if that fund is full, then it goes to the Education Stability Fund, and if the Education Stability Fund is full in terms of the stability part, not including the subaccount of capital, then the deposit amounts would revert back to the general fund. The bill, it raises the issue of the forecast and how accurate it's been, and we've asked, and actually he more or less volunteered for us and sent us over an updated set of history of the forecast, and it should be in your packet. It's a two-sided one. Has the numbers, should increase my font a little bit there, but that's the table for your forecast numbers. It's all there. Yes. And so it goes back to 81-83. So as they say, that is the time when we've kind of started the modern forecast process. And then the other side of that sheet is just the picture of that deviation from the close of session forecast. Now, there's some things that have come into play here other than just the economy, because these deviations are the result of some cases legal decisions, some cases voter actions, and some cases legislative actions. So, but if you look back historically, you can see that the forecast in 81-83 was 7.2% too high. And, of course, that was the time of the very sharp recession. And and you can see over in the far column is what are called structural revenues, which attempts to adjust for legislative actions. And, of course, there were a series of actions taken in the 82 special session, the biggest one being an increase, a three-year increase in personal income tax rates, and what became a three-year increase. And you can see without those legislative actions, there was about a 15% shortfall on the forecast. But following that sharp recession, 81-83, you can see that you had a pretty consistent pattern of revenue exceeding the forecast. And that was even true in 91-93, which was a recession. That was the time of the first Iraq War. And I remember preparing that forecast that became the close of session, trying to anticipate, you know, what the impact would be of higher oil prices and the war in the Middle East. The impact was a recession, but it turned out to be mild, and we still exceeded the forecast by 1.4%. So there, and you can see it in the pattern. In the mid-90s, we got up to 11.1%, and we've consistently were above that until 0103, where the structural deviation was minus 20.6%, 15.3% after the legislative actions were taken, including the appropriation credit bonds that were issued, the $450 million. And then the 0305 number is minus 2.8%, and that would have been a positive deviation had it not been for the referral and defeat of Measure 30. Remember, Measure 30 took nearly $800 million out of the revenue forecast, and if you add that back in, you would have about $11 million in actual collections, which would have exceeded the close of session. Of course, we still ended up with a corporate kicker in that period. And then finally, the latest is the March numbers, 12.4% above the close of session projection in our current period as we go look at a large kicker expected next biennium. So if you add all those up, those deviations, the pluses and minuses, and then divide by what's the average, the average is a plus 2.2%. So that potentially could be one adjustment mechanism in this, even though the bill doesn't expressly say how many biennia to use, that would be one way to do it, and you would add 2.2% to this close of session estimate to get a an adjusted close of session estimate, and then that would become what you would compare with actuals to determine what goes in the reserve fund. Now, the other issue that would come up here would be this would imply, through adjustment of what becomes a close of session forecast, a potential change in the kicker and how that's calculated, in which you have a new close of session. This adjusted base would become the benchmark for comparing the kicker estimate. And that, given that the kicker is in the Constitution, there potentially could be some legal challenges on those grounds that there was a change in that definition. So that would be one of the potential issues that may come up.
Okay. Do we have anyone to be heard? Not today. All right. Is this clear as mud, members?
Are you inviting questions?
Yes, and comments.
Okay. Okay, where to begin? Paul, if I understand you, Section 2 of the printed bill puts current practice in statute.
It pretty much does, Representative Berger. It you know, in terms of the forecast release and how
and,
it's released.
And who has requested this? I mean, to what purpose? I guess I know it's. I mean, Mr. Chair, maybe it's a question for you.
Yes.
I'll just leave it at who wants it, and then go on to Section 3, which is, which basically, because of what we just did on the rainy day fund, becomes sort of moot. Is that what I understand, or is this part of that? Paul.
Representative Berger, I would see this as a, as I said earlier, that this calculation is done. Of course, what you did in terms of the kicker itself was done merely on the, on a one-time basis. So you haven't changed that. One issue would be you have to make separate estimates for corporate and for non-corporate. So we would have to, we could make an adjustment on each of those in terms of determining that base. But since the fund is set up as Oregon Rainy Day Fund, you know, this, I would say, based on this language, an emergency reserve fund, it would fit that description. So what this would do is take the actual amount above that adjusted forecast and put it into the Oregon Rainy Day Fund following the biennium.
And in the first page of the bill that you discussed about is that adjustment that we're trying to create here. Whatever that adjustment is that what the first part does? Based on historical data, here.
Yes, the.
I'm going back and trying to understand what you just told us, Paul. If you understand what I'm doing.
Well, it says that there's an adjustment to be made based on the differences between the estimate and actuals in prior biennia. Okay, so that's what you have in this sheet, is the difference between actuals and close of session forecasts in prior biennia.
So based on the oddities of these numbers, there's a need for an adjustment. Is that what I'm hearing you say?
Well, based on those numbers, we have, on average, exceeded the forecast by 2.2% on average. And, of course, in terms, there have been more biennia that we've exceeded than not exceeded. When we've fallen below, we've tended to fall way below. In particular, 0103 and 8183, where we would have fallen even further below if you hadn't been forced to take actions to try to rebalance the budget. So the pattern has been consistently above during, you know, the expansion phase of the business cycle, which tends to last much longer than the recession phase, and significantly below in the recession phase. So that's been the pattern, and you average those out overall, we have tended to under forecast on average 2.2% each biennium. So if you use that as your calculation for prior biennia, as it says on line 19, you could add 2.2% to the close of session, say in 05-07, 2.2% to the 11,327,000,000, and you'd in effect reduce the difference between what actually came in and the adjusted forecast. That would be the net effect. You would reduce the difference between, if you're above forecast, what actually came in versus a close of session. You'd be creating a different close of session estimate that, if we use this historical pattern, would be 2.2% higher than what you otherwise would have.
Right, that part of the bill is clear. What's not clear to me is what Section 3 does.
Before we move on, though, Mr. Fisher, could I clarify something?
Please.
So, Paul, does this, have you gone back and recalculated what the kicker would have been using this method to see if how accurate it would have been? I mean, or recalculated the forecast, I mean?
Representative Rosenbaum, using this method on average, the kickers would have been smaller because you'd have a higher close of session base in which to compare the actuals with.
And that means the forecast would have been more accurate then?
Yes. Well, the forecast would have been more accurate. Well, you know, it's because it almost has to, by definition, because you're taking the actual deviations and building them in.
Right.
There's no guarantee.
Forecast is more accurate.
I guess what I'm saying is, so you arrived at that conclusion by using this method and applying it to see what we would have ended up with as opposed to what we actually had as the forecast?
Representative Rosenbaum, all I've done here, and actually all Michael did, Michael Kennedy, was look at what has been the deviation historically.
Right.
And that's in that chart. And if you average that out, it's about 2.2%. So if we would have raised the forecast by 2.2% each time, we would have been, on average, accurate. That doesn't mean that we wouldn't have been accurate in any single year, but the deviations would have balanced out, and we would have had technically an unbiased forecast.
Representative Gelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what would happen then if that was added in the years in which we fall short? Would we be budgeting off of that end of session forecast, and would we therefore, in the year where there's a 15.3% shortfall, would we be increasing that to a 17.3% shortfall?
You're actually anticipating the question. You're actually anticipating the question that I wanted to get to, because that's what Section 3 is about. And I think, I'm not sure that Section 3 says what I intended it to say, but I'm not certain about that. So I want to ask about that. But while we're still on the point that Representative Rosenbaum raised, if I just look at these errors in close of session forecast, these items here, just based on these numbers, and I take it that there was a corporate kicker in one of the years in which the total amount was actually less than 2%. Is that right, Paul?
That's correct.
Which year was that?
That was in 97-99.
Okay. So in 1.2 year, there actually was a corporate kicker because it was quite a bit more, I take it, than the 2%.
In 97-99, there was a personal kicker, but corporate was below.
Okay.
Mm. So, and because you're doing the two separate calculations, the actual kicker refund, you send back the next biennium, if you include that in the forecast, you're actually below the forecast in terms of net revenue if you include that refund.
But you end up with okay. That was okay. So if just looking at this, then we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 6 years in which there would still be a kicker out of the 9 that there were. Eight that there actually were, and one of those was kind of an odd time because one side kicked and the other didn't. There would still be a kicker in those years. In 2 years, it would make no difference at all. And in the one year, it would make a difference. It might not make a difference depending upon how much the personal number was above the 2%. Right. Okay. And on the down years, of course, it doesn't make any difference because there's no surplus. But I think that gets us to Representative Gelser's question and also to mine, which is what does Section 3 actually do? Which is, you didn't know you were asking that, but that's really what you're asking.
No, but I appreciate your interpretation.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I'm not exactly clear on what the request was of counsel, but what this says in Section 3 is that any difference between the actual amount of general fund revenues collected, that's your actual over here in the second column,
mm-hmm.
and the amount estimated in the last economic and revenue report to the Legislative Assembly before signage I, shall be deposited into a reserve fund. So
it does say what I wanted it to.
Okay.
So we actually have two numbers, don't we, that we're working from. The first number is ORS 291349 sub 2.
Right.
And that's the number that we now use as our
closes as our
governor's estimate,
right,
under the Constitution.
Right.
The other number that we're working with is the number that would be established by ORS 291.34, the lines 17 through 19 on page 1,
right,
of the bill. And if I understand it correctly, this basically says that any amount we get that doesn't get paid out in a kicker would go into reserve fund above the amount of the current estimate, the way the current estimate is calculated.
This is taking the actual amount that comes in. I guess I interpret it as taking the actual amount that comes in, the difference between that and that adjusted estimate that was in Section 2.
And the adjusted estimate.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the actual estimate is what we're talking about, isn't it? Maybe not. The intention of the bill, as I had in mind, and I'm answering Representative Berger's question now too. The intention was that any amount above the estimate prepared by the state economist, up to and including and maybe beyond the amount established by the estimate that would be made under line 17 through 19 on page 1, would go into the reserve account if it was actually collected.
Okay.
I'm not certain that says that.
Mr. Chair, I think that would be the difference between basically the unadjusted, which you're looking at.
Correct.
What you're saying, the unadjusted close of session versus the adjusted close of session.
Right.
Okay.
The object of, in my thinking about this bill, it was to separate the estimate made by the economist, which we're used to. We receive once a quarter. We get that estimate every quarter. To acknowledge that there's a difference between that amount and the long-term actuals. And the long-term actuals are 2.2% higher right now, maybe differently higher or lower at a different time. And to the extent that the economist's estimate is off the trend line by 2.2%, that amount ought to be available for a reserve account if we actually collect it or any part of it. So in the years in which there's a down cycle, there wouldn't be anything collected for the reserve account. Now I'm getting to Representative Gelser's question. Wouldn't be anything collected for the reserve account because we had a negative. We'd have to spend money anyway. But the budget wouldn't have been any higher than the amount it would have been otherwise, because it would have been based on the actual estimate from the estate economist, which presumably continues to include the same conservative bias it has now. But in all the other years that are listed here, something would have gone into the reserve account if this rule had been in effect at that time. And sometimes as much as the 2.2%, the average difference. Of course, the average changes every time you add another biennium, so you stay on the trend line. Representative Gelser, let's.
Thank you, Mr. Chair Barnhart. So I want to try the Cliff Note version to see if I get
come
this
up
right.
with a better way to All describe right. that. I'd love it.
So we have our end of session forecast. We budget to that. We allow a 2.2% cushion or grace area so that if our revenues come in higher, the first 2.2% doesn't count against the calculation of the corporate kicker.
Or the personal kicker.
Or the personal kicker.
Right. And that's exactly correct. And to allow for the other consideration, the other reason why we have a conservative forecast is that we not overspend. This bill would not allow us to spend that money. It wouldn't go into the budget. It would go into the reserve account to the extent it was collected.
That 2.2%
up to the 2.2%. Okay. Well, actually, the way this is drafted, if we make that little correction that needs to be made, it could be as much as 4.2% if it didn't kick. Once it kicks, of course, then everything above the estimate, the governor's estimate, kicks, and so that fund isn't available for the reserve account. But the amount below that and above the conservative estimate from the estate economist, but below the governor's estimate based on this bill, would still be available for the reserve account.
So could I do one quick follow-up?
Yes.
Just another Cliff Note check-in. So there's that 2.2% cushion. So essentially, anything above the projected revenue, that first 2.2% would go
right.
to the rainy day fund.
Yes.
The next 2% after that, so up to 4.2%, would be like we normally use. And above that 4.2% would go into a kicker.
The way this is drafted, that 2% would also go into the rainy day fund if we got to keep it. But the fact is, the way the rainy day fund law is written, if we have above the 2%, above the estimate, then all of it, down to the amount of the estimate, goes to the kicker. So it's not available for the rainy day fund. This is to deal with two issues. The first issue is the conservative bias of the current methodology for estimating the revenue, which has an overall rate of 2.2%. That's the average. And the other is to deal with the need to be conservative about our spending, not to spend more money than is actually available. And the third consideration is to continue building the rainy day fund. I mean, where would that money go? It goes into the rainy day fund. As you can see, in most of the biennia up till now, there would be dollars available for the rainy day fund out of this if this approach were followed.
Thank you.
So that's now it's obvious that it needs amendments because it didn't get drafted in quite the way I had in mind. But I think it's useful for a conversation to take place to discuss whether or not this is something the committee would like to look at further once amendments are drafted, or whether you think that this is something we ought to forget about. The point of it, of course, is to end up with a governor's estimated budget under the Constitution that is more accurate than the one we have now. That's the point of it, is to increase accuracy of that budget, but also deal with those other either legal or political realities having to do with the need to build a rainy day fund and having to deal with the need not to overspend.
So if I can summarize, Mr. Chair, kind of what the mechanics are, and I think we can get it drafted so we fit that. is that under the current situation, with our current forecast now, we're forecasting about roughly $12.7 billion. So under the proposal, that $12.7 billion would be compared not with an $11.3 billion close of session as we currently have, but roughly an $11.5 billion, 2% adjustment. So you'd have an effect instead of a deviation of 12.4% from the close of adjusted from the close of session, you'd have roughly a 10% deviation from the adjusted close of session. And the difference between the close of session forecast and the adjusted close of session, if our current numbers turn out to hold, would be going into reserve fund roughly $230 million.
That's right.
Okay.
But of course, this bill doesn't apply to the current biennium.
Yes.
Because the adjustment we're talking about can only be prospective.
Right.
We're telling the governor to write his estimate in a slightly different way. Yes, Representative Broome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe a question for Paul. I've got some, it's probably too early to have concerns, but I guess questions regarding the 2.2% and what the basis is for calculating that and how far back we're going. Obviously, we're not setting it on a firm 2.2%. That's today's average. That would have been a lot different prior to the 15% fall off a few years back. When is going to be the starting point? Are we going to call that 1980 period the starting point, or is it going to be a 10-year look back? I mean, maybe what's your desire here, Mr. Chair, on this? I mean, are we going to have a permanent starting point, or is it going to be a rolling average?
I think we could do it either way. What is statistically more accurate is the thing we'd want to use. The point of the bill is to increase the accuracy of the estimate. And whatever would increase the accuracy of the estimate, that's the number we should use.
Every time you have a really big year, negative or positive, you know, the 2001, 2003 comes to mind, it's going to skew tremendously. I mean, I don't know how to solve that other than just to...
Well, if you start from the beginning and keep adding years, and eventually
Genesis of the kicker?
Well, I suppose this number would retreat towards zero, although it might not. If in fact the estimate from the state economist is naturally conservative, normally biased conservative, we would expect that average most of the time would be positive. Right?
Right.
If in fact we simply don't have enough numbers yet, and that estimate is right on, we would expect that number to eventually get to zero. Might take a while, but it would eventually get to zero. If my assumption is correct, and I don't know there's any way to prove it one way or the other, but if my assumption is correct that the state economist has a naturally conservative estimate, then that average will likely always be positive, at least it will trend positive over time. It may not get a lot bigger than the current one.
Mr. Chair, I just would suggest that there are, this is not to either promote or demote the bill or the proposal here, if you will. I would suggest that, Paul, you know, maybe I'm wrong on this, that our methodology and our skill continues to evolve on how we do our forecasting, and it will be different 10 years from now than it is today, and it's certainly different today than it was 10 years ago. And so, and that isn't to, once again, not, Mr. Chair, not to be a positive or negative, it's just to state that having an average, depending on whether, I mean, there's problems with having a starting point in time and having that be the pure starting point going forward, and there's problems with having a rolling average. And both state their own set of issues.
Mr. Chair, if I may, Representative Broome is right. There you have benefits of both approach, but you know, from a forecaster standpoint, you like to think that your tools are improving.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, you get greater information technology and better data, and I think we've certainly spent a lot of effort in trying to do that. On the other hand, what you're forecasting is continually evolving and changing. So in the case of, and in my view, that's the more important factor. That's the greater uncertainty, is the economy is evolving, the way people are paid. We've talked about the instability in the income tax and how that reflects the use of bonuses, for example, or capital income and so forth. So I think that's the bigger source of error, and will tend to stay ahead of forecasting techniques and methodologies. I know that's somewhat pessimistic, but it also suggests that you maybe want to use a shorter time period, such as maybe the last five biennia, which would be more reflective of the current structure and may give you a better sense. And if you do go over a five biennia period, you, given recent business cycles, you're going to capture an entire cycle in most cases. So something like that might be a practical solution, to say that the difference should be based on the average deviation over the last five biennia. That way you'd be continually updating.
And, of course, that would be a negative number at this point.
It would be a negative number going into 05-07, but not beyond 507.
Oh, that's right, because we have this increase this year.
Yes.
Well, I don't know. It might still be a negative.
It would be pretty close to zero over a five-year period.
Pretty close to zero. We're at 12.4 right now, based upon my calculation, the current value. Mm-hmm.
So we do have, well, that's true. The 95-97 was a similar magnitude of error than the 05-07.
Mm-hmm.
So since 95-97 was on my watch, I'm actually glad we've got a larger margin of error now on this. Get out of the record book.
Get out of the record book. You don't. Yeah. Oh, you were the state economist in 0507.
In 95.97.
That's
95.97.
That 15.3 negative was is going to be the all time though.
Yeah. Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr.
You've
Chair.
You've been very patient.
I have appreciated the very fertile ground that's been plowed in that process. Of course, we have this does not affect the actual ways and means process, which, including House Bill 2707, which is now law, sets aside a 1% of the actual forecasted amount into the reserve itself. So it's excuse me, when Representative Geltzer asked if it could be a total of something approaching 4.2%, you look at that and you say, no, the 2% forces the kicker, so the 2% goes back. It could be 3.2%, however, that would end up in that rainy day fund. The concern that I have when we start talking about any of the kind, and this was a question I think I've asked at least twice before publicly, and that is, and I appreciate the fact that Paul has touched on it ever so briefly, and that is, what is the pushback going to be with regard to the fact that the kicker is in the Constitution and we have a close of session date? Once we begin the process of truing up the close of session conservative bias that is there, my concern is that there is going to be a constitutional challenge relative to any of those kinds of truing up, and perhaps maybe the better discussion would be on improving our forecasting tools as opposed to attempting. And looking at the 12.4, and I don't know whether that calculation is a good calculation or not. I just did a quick calculation on the 11.3 close of session versus the 12.7 that we're looking at right now, collecting an individual, and this only deals with the individual that we've been talking about here. The 12.4 is what that appears to be up at this particular time, and if we're talking about better and better forecasting tools, when you look at the last three biennia and you say, wait a minute, If in the last three biennia we've had much improved forecasting tools with variations of minus 15 to a positive of 12.4, when the maximum that we were out during the last five or six or seven biennia before that was a positive 11.3, pretty good indication that the tools we're working with maybe are reflective of the fact that Oregon is a very, very single source dependent tax state.
Very volatile. And I think you could, if Representative Butler, add to that that perhaps this idea that our forecasting capacity is improving may be less accurate than we might wish.
I've seen the dartboard over in the economist's office, and there's holes clear over next to the window seal. So.
All right. Thank you. Anything further on this discussion? I think this was an attempt, again, getting into the theory of things, to improve the accuracy of the estimate and deal with a couple of other issues at the same time. I would be curious about people's sense of whether this may be a useful tool or not as you have a chance to think about it. And if it's okay with the committee members, I'll send out some inquiries about that so we can decide whether we want to hold another hearing, get some real economists other than Paul here talking about it, I got to say this correctly, don't I? In addition to Paul here talking about it, so we have more than one economist's opinion. And see what others think about it. This is the psychologist's attempt to use a quasi-statistical analysis to approach a problem in another field, always an item of extreme danger.
Mr. Chairman, I think we need to spend a day on regression analysis here.
Well, if we did that, Representative, we would end up with something other than the average. We would then come up with a much more complicated formula. It was hopeful. I was hoping that perhaps the committee could deal with an average of the legislature. I know the committee can deal with regression analysis, but I'm not sure that all of the entire legislature can. And before I dig my hole any deeper, I think we should stop. Anything else? Thank you. With that, we'll adjourn the public hearing, and we've exhausted our agenda yet again today, and therefore we adjourn the committee.